Hi, I'm Dr. Tim Clinton from the American Association of Christian Counselors. Family Talk is a listener-supported program. I encourage you to support Dr. Dobson, his ministry, and this program. You can find us at drjamesdobson.org. Join forces today with Dr. Dobson as he continues to stand in the gap. Your gift can make all the difference at this critical time in our nation.
Today on Family Talk.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Dobson, and you're listening to Family Talk, which is a division of James Dobson Family Institute. Because it's fairly new, some of our listeners are interested in what that institute consists of. Actually, it has four divisions. The first is the radio program, Family Talk, and that's where we started. We were a young ministry, and that's where we began with the daily broadcast. From there, we've gone on to a division of public policy, the Dobson Digital Library, and the arena of education. I'll tell you more about that later. For today, you're going to hear a wonderful story of a man named David Nasser. He was a Muslim born in Iran during the turbulent revolution. David now works at Liberty University as a vice president of spiritual development. He also founded the D. Nasser Outreach, which is focused on fulfilling the Great Commission through preaching, providing resources, and mentoring to the next generation. This is a man you'll want to hear from. He has authored three books, Jumping Through Fire, Glory Revealed, and A Call to Die, which he wrote with singer and songwriter Chris Tomlin. He's a dynamic speaker, and I know you're going to enjoy what you're about to hear. Let's get to his presentation that we've titled God's Righteous Right Hand on this edition of Family Talk.
Good evening. I would like to read a passage out of Isaiah tonight. Isaiah 41:9. When I was about 9 years old, we had to escape from my country because of the Iranian Revolution. And all my life, as I've looked back at it, and I have only lived a couple of years of it, I guess, as a 27-year-old, there's, I think, the best yet to come. As a newlywed, I think the best is definitely yet to come, and there are a lot of neat things that are happening. But at the same time, as I've looked at my life, I've seen that most of my life has been a life full of fear. All of my life, I've been afraid. And this passage is one that I read all the time. I read it when I give my testimony. I read it just about every day when I get up in the morning. And it has been the passage that I hang on to. A promise from the original promise keeper. A promise from a God that says to me not to be afraid. Isaiah 41:9. I took you from the ends of the earth, from its farthest corners I called you. I said that you are my servant. I always kind of, for years, as I would read this thing, never pay much attention to that part. I always would go right to the part where I would see how I'm not supposed to be afraid, how God is my God. And lately, that's been my bigger focus right there, where God has said to me that I have the opportunity to wash feet, not so much have mine washed, but to be a servant. And that in itself is a blessing. I said that you are my servant. I have chosen you and I have not rejected you. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, and I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. What a promise that is. I remember as a 9-year-old kid, one day sitting in my classroom, I went to a classroom, a military class in Iran that had basically about 1,000 students in it. It was not just a class, but the entire school. And I remember I was sitting in my classroom one day and a soldier walked in and said that we were going to have a school assembly. We all piled outside of our school for the assembly. We didn't have a place to meet indoor. And as we went outside, I knew that it was not going to be a fun assembly because my school principal was standing in front of the whole school crying. Well, we all settled down and my school principal nodded okay to a soldier and he came and he stood in front of our entire school. And I remember he got out a sheet of paper and he said, I'm about to read on this list the name of three students. And I want these three students to come and stand here in front of the whole school. Well, my name was the first one that he read out. I stood up and I started walking in front of our entire school. And before this guy could even read the other two names, he dropped the piece of paper. I remember he took out a gun and he pointed it to me with his hands shaking. He said, "I'm about to kill you right now." That's one of my first memories of a child. I remember being so afraid, and I remember thinking, this guy's got to be kidding, but apparently he wasn't, because the school principal got between me and the gun, and she started to cry, and she said, "Please don't do this. Come back another time." Or for all I care, I didn't have to come back another time, and I went home that afternoon, and I asked my dad why this guy wanted me dead. Now, I've only seen my dad cry two times in my entire lifetime, and later on, in just a few minutes, I'll tell you when was the second time that I've seen him. He's a military man. He's very macho, and I remember my dad started to cry, and he sat me on his lap, and he said, "Son, don't be afraid. The guy's not going to get you." What I did not understand at that time was that my country, Iran, was in a revolution. In 1979, the Iranian Revolution was taking place. And with the revolution taking place, they were killing everybody who was anybody. And we knew that it was only a matter of time, for sure, where they were going to kill my dad and possibly our entire family. I remember going to school the very next day, and some of my best friends were missing. And I said, "Where's this guy? And where's this guy?" And they said, "Well, didn't you hear? Their fathers were executed last night, and their families are in hiding." So we knew that we had to escape. Back then, my mom had a slight heart condition, so we said, we used that to our advantage, and we said that we need some help. We called our doctors, her heart specialists, and they agreed to help us. Basically, not because they were friends, but because we paid them almost all the money that we had. And we told them that we need this help, and we rushed mom to the hospital on an afternoon, and she acted like her heart was really bothering her. The doctors ran her in, they ran her back out, and they said, "The family needs to go immediately to Switzerland for open heart surgery. This lady's not going to make it within the next 24 hours, and we don't have the technology to have this surgery." So we got two-way airplane tickets, like we were going and coming back, and we got the homework assignments, like we were going and coming back, and the house sitter, like we were going and coming back. But we weren't coming back, we were running for our lives. I remember the fear of holding my dad's hand in that airport, and his hand just kept shaking, and he kept looking at my mom, and he kept saying, "If they find out that we're escaping, they're going to kill us right here on the spot." But when you look at your testimony, it's not so much that week at camp, disciple now, disciple later, revival or whatever, when you got saved and then on, but your testimony is how God's righteous right hand protected you even before you knew him, and how God chose you before you even knew that there was such a thing. And I look back and I can see how even before we knew him, he knew us. God took us out of Iran and brought us out of there, and we went to Switzerland, and we were stuck in Switzerland for 9 months. And after 9 months, we finally made it to the United States. Well, finally, I thought things were going to get better for me. Finally, I thought as a 9-year-old kid, I'm going to come here, I'm going to make friends. But things didn't get better, they got worse. Because being an Iranian wasn't the very hip thing to be. I come to school, I came from the wrong culture, I had the wrong haircut, the wrong clothes. I didn't speak any English. The only English that I knew, Dr. Rogers, was, "Hello, my name is David," because my dad taught me that on the way to school. I had a big old afro, I looked like Snoop Puppy Pup or something. And I remember I walk into school, and everybody looked at me like I was the weirdest kid. And I thought, nobody likes me because I'm from another country. And I hated who I was. I hated the fact that we'd escaped halfway across the world to come to a place where we can finally be accepted. And all we had done was come to a place where we were going to be more shunned out than ever before. Well, I remember my freshman year in high school was about to start. I was finally going to be a freshman in high school. And a lot of people get excited about that, but I wasn't excited because I didn't want school to start the next day. So I'm sitting in my room and I'm crying. My dad hears me crying. He comes to the room. He says, "Son, what's wrong?" I said, "Dad, please don't make me go to school tomorrow. I hate my life. I hate all the nicknames. I hate all this stuff. Why can't we just go back to Iran? Can we do that?" And we'd been in America long enough to know where to go when you're sad by this time. My dad says, "Son, let's go." I said, "Where are we going?" He takes me to the mall. Well, we go to the mall, and my dad buys me some new clothes, and I get this pork chop, grease back looking haircut, and I get all these different things, and he gives me a new car. All he could do at my age was go back and forth in the driveway, but I got a new car, new clothes, new haircut, and overnight, I went to school, and overnight, I went from geek to chic. I went from Abdul to Julio. I mean, I go to school, and the guy that for years and years never got talked to by any of the girls, never got talked to by any of the guys except when they were making fun, all of a sudden, just because of a new outside, people were accepting me. And none of us ever wake up in the morning and go, "Well, today I'll be a sociopath." We all want to blend in. And I found that all I had to do to blend in was to become on the outside what people wanted me to become. And for the first time in my life, some of that fear was going away. For the first time in my life, I was walking into school and people weren't going, "You can't sit here, this seat's saved." But they were going, "Hey, Nasser, why don't you come sit with us?" And I liked the attention. So by the time I graduated, I was the one that wanted to be popular. I was the one that wanted to be known. and I had met all my goals. By the time I graduated, I was the one in all the yearbooks. I was the one in all these different things. But all I had become was a gutless wonder who was pleasing everybody else. And my friend told me, he said, David, you know what you need to do? You need to come to church with me. I said, man, I can't go to church. We're Muslims. We don't do the church thing. He said, look, Dave, all the people that we party with, they go to this big church down the street. He said, it's no big deal. You're thinking the wrong thing. And I wanted to go somewhere to be accepted. Well, I go to church for the first time not knowing what to expect. Big old church like this one, I walk into the Christian Life Center where all the youth were, and everybody I partied with was right there in church. Did y'all know this? People in Alabama, they'll go to church, but then like outside of church, they'll live another kind of life. I know. Pray for them. Anyway, so man, I go to church, and everybody I party with is there, and I thought, this is no big deal. I walk up, I'm high-fiving all my friends, and every other word out of my mouth is a curse word because I didn't know how to act like everybody else knew how to act in church. But all my friends, even the one that invited me to church, is embarrassed to be standing next to me. So within 3 minutes, everybody's as far away from me in the room as can be. Well, I'm standing there and the youth minister comes up. He goes, we're running late. Everybody have a seat right now. And we sit down. And the next thing you know, man, I look up there in the front row. I'm sitting all by myself and I see this guy, Larry No, walking towards me. Now, it took me a second to figure it out because we'd only met one other time. Let me tell you when we met. Larry No had one other time, a year and a half before that, the one time we met, had come to a party that I was at and had tried a witness to me and all my friends. I remember laughing at him out loud as he walked away and we all laughed at him. And a year and a half later, I'm sitting there and he's walking towards me and I'm thinking he's going to get revenge now. He walks up and goes, David Nasser, I remember you. That's what I was afraid of. I said, hey, how you doing? He goes, man, can I sit with you? I said, you want to sit with me? He said, yeah. I sat down. I said, sure. I mean, if you want to sit down, you can. He sat down beside me, and the youth minister said, everybody turn into your Bible, into this and this. And I didn't have a Bible because I hadn't been to the hotel to steal one from the Gideons yet, so I didn't have one. I felt kind of left out. And the next thing you know, I looked down, and there was a Bible on my lap. Larry No had opened up his Bible and put it on the right page so I wouldn't feel left out and put it on my lap. Well, the entire time this guy's teaching the lesson, I keep thinking, why is this guy so nice to me? I was so mean to him. When the Sunday school lesson's over, he looks at me and he says, David, why don't you keep that Bible? I said, no, I don't want to do that. He said, look, if you just keep that Bible, Monday night, I'll come to your house. We do this thing as Baptists called visitation. I had no idea. Man. And he said, and I'll come over and I'll bring a Bible with your name on it. People always make fun of me because I carry this old Bible. It's been beaten down. I was telling Jenny the other day, I got to get it rebounded now for the third time. And people always make fun of me because I carry this thing. But I love this Bible because a kid named Larry No thought enough of me to go out on an afternoon and buy me a Bible and put my name on it. He forgot an S. It's misspelled, but it doesn't matter. And I love the fact that he just loved on me. And every Monday night, it was a pound cake and a Bible. Let's go terrorize the Iranians. We're like, hide. The Baptists are coming. The Baptists are coming. Hide. And they would come and they would not leave our house. And these people told us about Jesus Christ. They told us about how there was a man named Jesus Christ that had died on the cross for me, how he loved me, how he had shed his life, and but went in a tomb on a Friday and on Sunday. And all these things seemed like a big fiction story. But every time those church doors were open, I was right back in that church again. You know why? Because love is a magnet. See, my testimony is not about an Iranian kid that made good. It's about a church that loved somebody that was different. And this church started to love on me and my family. And for the first time in my life, I'd seen boyfriend, girlfriend love. I'd seen mom and dad love, brother, sister love. But for the first time in my life, I was seeing that people can just love you because they love a man named Jesus Christ. And I started going to that church. Every time those church doors were open, I was back in that church. And after about 3 months of sitting there, the only time I didn't like, the hour of fear is what I called it. I know you guys call yours the hour of power. I call it the hour of fear because I would sit there and I was again afraid because he would talk about how Jesus died for me, so I need to live for him. And I didn't want to do that. I thought, here's my entire life full of fear, and here's a man trying to scare me into some decision. And I remember one night after about a couple months of going there, while everybody else was coming forward doing the invitation, I hit the aisle and I went the other way. And I thought, I'm not coming back to one of these churches again. Well, I left that church and the next thing you know, I went home that afternoon and I was so angry with God. I was so afraid. And I went in that room and I had a stack of Bibles because all these Christians have brought me Bibles. And I went and got the top one and I was so angry. And I remember just started to struggle that night. My parents weren't home that night. They were coming in later on. And after about 20 minutes of struggling back and forth in this spiritual tug of war, I finally surrendered my heart to Jesus Christ. I hit one knee, and I knew all the fancy words, sanctification and redemption, because all those people had taught it to me. I didn't use any of those. I just said, Jesus, save me from myself. My parents came home a couple hours later, And they said, son, you look different. I said, I got saved. You know what my dad said? Saved from what? He didn't know. I started explaining to him what it meant to be a Christian. And my dad said, now, son, are you saying that your mom and your dad and everybody in back home in Iran, everybody's going to hell except you? And I said, yes, sir. And that's not a very good thing to say to a military dad from our... My dad started to look at me, and my mom started to tug at his jacket, and they went in that other room, and I wasn't in that room, but I know what they were talking about. Hey, it's just another stage in David's life. Let him go through it. But they didn't understand that when you become a Christian, it's not a stage, it's a rebirth. And man, the next thing you know, let me tell you how naive I was. I thought, since I'm a Christian, I ought to witness to people. I didn't know it was a job of people that got paid to do it on staff. I started to tell all my friends about Jesus. I go back to my high school where everybody knew me as a partier, and I went and I said, you need Jesus and you need Jesus. I went out with you. I know you need Jesus. And the next thing you know, my friends were getting saved. Well, all of a sudden, it's the billboard for the convention. You know, Iranian kid got saved. 4th of July is my biggest weekend. And then, you know, come by and tell us how good we are as Americans. And all of a sudden, I got thrown into ministry and everything, and it got real heavy at the house. The night that it all went down was the night that I went to get baptized in my church. I remember going to get baptized in my church and my mom hanging onto my leg, and I'm trying to walk to the door, and she kept saying, don't embarrass us. Please don't go out there in front of all those people and become a baptized person. I went home that night with my hair wet, and I remember my dad had the bags packed, and he said, now, son, did you get baptized tonight? I said, yes, sir. And he said, you might want to look for a place to live. And I found out, just because you're a Christian, it doesn't mean that fear goes away. I found out that just because you're a Christian doesn't mean everything's going to get easy. And I went out, and with all the faith that I had, I found out as an insecure young man that I still am, that I just had to trust in God. I had to trust in that righteous right hand. Same kid that got kicked out of the house after about 5 months of being a Christian, I got a phone call from my sister, and she was weeping on the phone, and she said, I gave my heart to Jesus tonight. Then my mom, that same mom that was begging me, is now one of the most on fire for God Christians that I know. God say. Oh, I love my mom. I love her zeal for God. My little baby brother, he's Down syndrome. Benji got saved after my mom got saved. And everybody in my family was a Christian except my dad. And my dad was so angry. To him, I was the prodigal son because I had led the family astray to a place called Christianity. And my dad was so angry at that. He hated the way that I said the word God. He always made fun of that. He said, why do you always say God? And the way you say it is. And he always found some little thing to make fun of. And I love my dad. But at the same time, I could see how his pride had been hurt. I told you that my mom needed open heart surgery that didn't really exist. Well, this is how I'd like to leave you with tonight, just to tell you what God did in my dad's life. My dad was so offended at our Christianity, and my mom, she would just put little Bible verses in the refrigerator, in the bed, everywhere, and my dad would just even get more and more callous to it. And a few years ago, after a few years of my mom being a Christian, they took her to the hospital one night, and my mom, they told her, you can't leave the hospital, we got to have open heart surgery on you next week. I don't know if you know the feeling of someone that you love looking at you on a stretcher and saying, if I never see you again, I love you. Take care of your family. My mom got put in that stretcher, and it was just the immediate family, my dad, my brother, my sister, and I. And we all just kind of were following my mom as they were taken in there to replace a valve here and this and this and this and whatever all they had to do. And I remember we were just walking with mom, and as we get to this one point where there's these doors that are closed and it says authorized personnel only, my mom and everybody stops and the nurses are around us and we're saying our goodbyes, but we're saying these are not really goodbyes, everything's going to be okay. And my sister looks at the doctor and she says, can I please go inside that room and just pray outside the door? Well, they didn't want to say no because they're supposed to keep the morale up for somebody going through open heart surgery. So they said, yes, but only you. They nipped it before I could ask. So they go in there together, and it's me, my dad, and my little baby brother, Benji. And we're standing outside that door, and about 20 minutes later, my sister just runs out with the doors just wide open. She goes, David, David, everybody, come in right now. And we're like, what's going on? We run inside. As soon as we run inside, she goes, they just almost lost mom. They just almost lost mom, and they're going to bring her out. They say that they don't think she's going to make it. They never say something like that. They don't think she's going to make it. We need to pray. And all of a sudden, they bring mom before she can even finish. What had happened was, before you can have open heart surgery, they've got to shoot some dye into your heart and videotape the flowage and the blockage or whatever that is. Well, my mom's heart was so blocked that when they shot the dye in her heart, they lost her. And they had to electrocute her, shock her twice to bring her back. Well, my mom comes back out, and she looked like she was already dead. I mean, she looked like she wasn't going to make it anyway. She didn't look like she was half alive. And I remember holding her hand. I said, "Mom, everything's going to be fine. You're going to be okay." And the doctor said, "We don't have any more time." And they rushed her back in that room, and they closed that door. And as soon as they closed that door, my sister looks at me, and she says, "Start praying for this red light not to come on." There's this red light sitting outside the top of the door. I said, "Why?" She goes, "All I know is last time this red light came on and started flashing. And as soon as the red light started flashing, people had to rush in to shock and electrocute mom to bring her back." I said, "Okay." And I love to say that I was praying like a tender warrior, but I'd never been more afraid in my entire life. As a kid that's lived his entire life full of fear, I'm telling you, that was the pinnacle of it. That was the summit. I was standing around, I was thinking to myself, how am I going to tell my brother? How am I going to explain to him that she's in a place called heaven? That she is at the Holy of Holies. She's bowing her knees. She's like that song that she was singing about. How am I going to explain all that to Benji? How is he going to understand? And I'm walking around, and all of a sudden I hear this, "No, no." And I look, and my sister has her hands on the door, and she's on both knees. She's going, "God, no, please, God, please, no." And I look up there, and that light is on, and it's just flashing. So I ran to the door. I put my hands on the door. And I said, "God, please, no. God, please." And we both hit our knees, and we were just had our hands like this, and we're going, "God, please, no. Please don't take mom away. God, please, please, please." And man, all of a sudden I look, and from behind me, for the first time in my dad's life, my dad was on one knee. He put his hand on my shoulder, and my dad, for the first time in his entire life, went, "Jesus, please, no. Please, Jesus, no." And I looked up there, and all of a sudden, the second my dad yelled out the name of Jesus, folks, that light stopped flashing. 2 weeks later, the operation went fine. Everything was okay. We were moving mom out of the hospital. I took a moment while everybody was laughing, and I said, "Hey, mom, you know the other day when we lost you again? Guess who was yelling out to Jesus? Daddy was." My mom looks over at my dad, and she goes, "So now you believe in Jesus?" My dad goes, "Yes." So now you go to church with us? "Yes." "You're going to start tithing?" "No." "You'll make a good Baptist," I told him. And I wish I had said it, but I was just so shocked that my dad had even said that. Yeah. My sister looked over at my dad, and she said, "Dad, it's not about believing in a Jesus. It's about accepting him." I remember my dad closed his eyes, and he prayed to receive Christ. God's been so good to me. Let me ask you a question, folks, before we go into invitation tonight. I know most of you came here tonight and you'd already made up your decision what the invitation was going to be like for you. I know most of you came here tonight and you said, "There's no way that the super glue that I have between me and this seat is going to get me up." But let me ask you a question before we close out tonight. What has God done in your life that was so bad? What has God done in your life that was so bad for you to look at God and say, "You know what, God, that's a great little promise for the little Iranian boy, but you haven't been the promise keeper to me." Has God been good to you? Has God been good to you? Has God been good to you? Are you good back? Are you good back? For most of us, God is nothing more than a waiter. "Give me, give 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 me." Folks, you're going to treat God like a waiter? Start at least tithing 15%. That's what a waiter gets at a restaurant. And for most of us, all our Christianity is, "God, what can you do for me?" Instead of looking at that passage right before where he says, "Don't be afraid, you fall under my righteous right," and you looking and saying, "Look, he has chosen me to be his servant." What has God done in your life that was so bad for you to go, "You know what, God, you don't deserve every one of my days. You know what, God? I can live the way I want to." Basically put this way, what does your Christianity cost you? Does it cost you anything? Is it membership? Is it association? Is it, "Hey, it better be good on Wednesday and it better be funny. Man, I hope the sermon keeps me excited. I hope he might even throw in a joke." No, what about coming here and rolling up your sleeves and saying, "Father, you've been good to me. Now what can I do back? What can I give?"
What a powerful story of God's provision, his protection, and his saving grace. This is James Dobson, and if you were moved by today's broadcast, I would really like you to call us. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 877-732-6825. When you connect with us, you'll have the option of leaving a message or a broadcast suggestion to our listener feedback line. Or if you prefer, you can talk to someone in our offices here in Colorado. Colorado Springs. Our representatives will pray with you or offer any of our helpful resources. Our number again is 877-732-6825. If you'd like to learn more about David's incredible story or his organization, visit the broadcast page at drjamesdobson.org. I am James Dobson. Thanks for listening to us today, and I hope you'll join us next time for more Family Talk.
This has been a presentation of the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute.
Hi, this is Dr. Tim Clinton. Thanks for listening to Family Talk. You going through a tough time right now? Can't see your way out? You think there's no hope? We'd love to talk to you. I want you to know this. Dr. Dobson has been doing this for a long time, and he really cares about you so much that we'd love to talk to you right now. You can actually call us toll-free. Our number is 877-732-6825. You're going to be encouraged. You're going to be challenged. You're going to find new hope. You know why? Because God really does care about you. He loves you. And Dr. Dobson cares about you too. Call us now, 877-732-6825.